The final investigator I met with was Dr. Howard Hoxter from the Yale School of Medicine, and to begin, he commented on the question of 3 versus 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy of colon cancer.
So I personally, when I do the 3-month treatment, I started somebody last week on this, I'm trying to give people capox, and that was not my normal practice. I really don't like capecitabine because of the extra toxicity and the need for patients to take it twice a day for 14 days every 3 weeks and all those kind of things. But I have really adopted that as the kind of standard for low risk stage 3.
I'm curious about this patient where you just started on 3 months. What was the patient's situation?
Well, he was a gentleman who had some rectal bleeding, and they found that he had a sigmoid colon cancer that was T3N1, and the N1 was deposit equivalent. There were actually 31 other lymph nodes that were negative, but he's just into the stage 3 category, so I feel pretty comfortable that his cure rate with 3 months of capox will be equivalent. But, you know, for us, it's a little bit new kind of trying to manage the capecitabine because we've tended to always give people the 48-hour 5-FU infusion.
I'm just kind of curious more a little bit about this man. How old did you say he was?
He's 58.
58. Okay, so he's a younger man. And is he the kind of patient that if you said, you know, I've got two possibilities here. One might be a tiny, tiny better. Is he the kind of patient who says, I don't care what kind of toxicity it is, just give me everything, or more like, I want to maintain quality of life?
Well, you know, it's hard to say in this situation what the quality of life issues are. I mean, the CAPE could have more side effects than the 5-FU, but it's 3 months and less long-term neuropathy. So I actually told him that we could do the regular 6 months, but I think that the shorter course is really the equivalent in his case, and he was willing to accept the shorter course and take the pills. And I believed also that he would be very compliant with taking his capecitabine.
Well, let me ask you, if you see a benefit with capecitabine, and it's always been interesting how U.S. investigators don't like capox, and for the same reasons that you were just mentioning. But if you think there's a slight benefit, you know, in the lower risk patients, then why wouldn't you give it to a higher risk patient too?
Well, the data showed that even with the 6 months, it doesn't really pan out to be much better. It's really in the 3 months that you see a much better outcome with the capecitabine compared to FOLFOX.
I mean, globally, do you believe that chemotherapy causes a relative risk reduction in general? That, for example, I don't know, you know, 3 months with CAPOX, maybe you're looking at, say, 5% relative risk reduction or 10% at the most difference. Do you think that that then, whatever it might be, if that's what it is, you then could just apply it across the absolute risk so that if it's a lower absolute risk, you get less benefit, higher, or you don't think it works that way?
Well, I think that's a question that we've debated a lot. I tend to believe that the relative risk reduction is the same, be it stage 2, stage 3. So today with stage 2, people appear to be at higher risk by either pathologic or oncotype, whatever, I will also offer them adjuvant therapy. So yes, I think the relative risk reduction is the same. You know, if it's stage 2, low risk stage 3, or high risk stage 3, but giving 3 months of treatment may not be the equivalent for the higher risk patients.
So any stage 2 patient you treat, you're going to treat for 3 months now?
I would, yes.
Okay, well, that's at least a practical personal guideline anyhow. We'll see how it actually plays out in practice. I want to ask you also where things stand right now with HER2 positive, amplified, but maybe mutant also, colorectal cancer, where we are today in terms of how often this occurs and what we know about interventions. And I'm really interested to hear about the new SWOG study looking at that.
Well, thank you for asking that. So we've been working on developing a study in SWOG for the last year or so, and we finally managed to negotiate a lot of issues, including with the FDA. So this study should open up in the next 2 weeks. It's SWOG 1613. So what we know is that about 4 to 5% of colorectal cancer overexpresses HER2, and it's probably a negative risk factor like in breast cancer. I mean, there's a lot of preclinical data and some clinical data to suggest that. Additionally, we know that most of these will be RAS wild type. There's very few HER2 overexpressed patients in the RAS mutated group. So if you look at it that you take the half of the colon cancer patients that have RAS wild type, now we're talking about maybe 10% that would be HER2 overexpressing. So that's a reasonable group to study. In Europe, they did a multi-center phase 2 study of 27 patients, the Heracles study, where they used trastuzumab and lapatinib, and it looked like the response rate was 30%, and another 30% more or less had stable disease. So some real benefit for heavily pretreated patients. In the SWOG study, we're looking for second or third line patients that have not had cetuximab previously, and those patients will be randomized to a control arm of irinotecan and cetuximab for the RAS wild type group, as you know, all of them will be RAS wild type, and the experimental arm will be a combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab, so that they'll get a double antibody blockade of HER2. And we're going to be enrolling 100 patients, and it'll be a control trial, very similar to the BRAF study we recently completed. And we hope that will give a lot of really solid controlled evidence as to the benefit of treating this patient group specifically with therapy targeted to their HER2.
I'm curious why you all chose to use pertuzumab and trastuzumab in breast cancer. That's not too effective unless you add chemo to it first. What about that?
Right. Well, of course, we don't have clinical data to suggest one thing over the other. However, we haven't seen a lot of benefit either with lapatinib, and I think that the kind of general feeling was that this was probably the best way to target the pathway.
You mentioned the Heracles study looking at lapatinib, trastuzumab. Have you yourself utilized it? I don't even know if you can access these drugs. Have you treated any patients with this approach?
I haven't. We haven't been systematically screening for HER2, though we started in the last couple months.
Now, what about HER2 mutations? You hear a lot about that in lung cancer. I'm starting to hear a little bit about that in breast cancer. What about in colorectal cancer?
Yeah, once in a while you can find an actual point mutation in HER2 that's an activating mutation. These drugs should be equally effective. They're not specifically excluded if they have overexpressed protein. So it's just in this particular study, they have to qualify on the IHC test.
And when you talk about overexpression, is it the same as breast cancer IHC 3 or FISH greater than 2?
Yes. And we just submitted all the data to the FDA for an investigational device exemption.
Just to clarify, though, you're not impressed enough with the Heracles result to actually try to use it, or you think you couldn't get it paid for, or what do you think?
Well, I think that it's an equally valid way to approach, you know, the blockade of this pathway, kind of with a vertical pathway versus dual antibody targeting. So I don't know that one's better than the other, but this is just a study we were able to support in the U.S.
I'm curious to pick up on some of the research that you've been involved with, one being some work I know you presented earlier this year at the ASCO GI meeting looking at the so-called STEAM study, S-T-A-M. What was that and what have we learned from it?
That was looking at sequencing of first-line therapy with FOLFOX or FOLFIRI or FOLFOXIRI, all with bevacizumab. So based on the European trials that showed FOLFOXIRI, Bev seemed to be better in terms of response rate and PFS, and maybe even survival, compared to FOLFIRI Bev, we wanted to look at if you really needed to give the triplet or you could use sequential doublets. And so this was a randomized phase 2 of three arms, FOLFOXIRI, FOLFOX-BEV, or FOLFOX 1 month, FOLFIRI the other month, alternating months. And it turned out that both the, what they call concurrent FOLFOXIRI, which was, you know, giving all three drugs at once, or the sequential, the monthly alternating one, did have a better response rate and PFS than the control arm, which was FOLFOX. So this does seem to suggests that early introduction of irinotecan may be beneficial in patients who have very aggressive tumors or need rapid debulking, high response rate issues, and that if somebody can't really tolerate a triplet, you could probably get very close to the same results by alternating FOLFOX and FOLFIRI 1 month of one regimen and 1 month of the other.
It's interesting about that alternating regimen. What's your experience with it in terms of toxicity, and are you actually using it in your practice?
I haven't really been using it in practice because I think there's something actually pharmacologically that is an interaction between a TOPO1 inhibitor like irinotecan with oxaliplatin. So I like the idea of giving them concurrently. And, you know, if you're used to giving FOLFIRINOX to pancreatic patients, giving FOLFOXIRI to a lot of fairly healthy colon cancer patients is really not more difficult, and it's probably easier. So I haven't really used the alternating that much. But I do have patients, you know, a couple a month that I will start on FOLFOXIRI.
So you talked about earlier introduction to irinotecan, some kind of triplet, FOLFOXIRI Bev, you know, for example, in tumors with more adverse outcomes, prognoses. So I'll ask you first, what I have been hearing about for a couple years now, BRAF mutant disease. In general, are you using that approach there?
Yes, for a patient where we discover a BRAF mutation, I will treat originally with FOLFOXIRI, and then we would go on to a BRAF study, previously SWOG-1406, which closed, but now there's another study that's looking at a BRAF inhibitor with or without a MEK inhibitor.
So here's one that kind of surprised me. I just interviewed your colleague, Dr. Alan Vanook, yesterday, and I'm kind of still processing. I think he said to me that he's doing it now for right-sided metastatic disease, not BRAF. I mean, BRAF also, but right-sided. He's so convinced by the adverse impact that he wants to start with FOLFOXIRI Bev. Are you doing that? What do you think about it?
I haven't really adopted a policy like that to say all right-sided patients should get it, but I think it's rational, and my threshold for using FOLFOXIRI in right-sided patients who have, you know, RAS mutation would be pretty low, actually. So if a young, relatively healthy person comes in with disease that I'm trying to get to surgical resection and they have a right-sided tumor, I really wouldn't hesitate.
So I'm curious, though, that your trial calls for the use of cetuximab. I think I saw, maybe that was another paper, Johanna Bendel in, but in any event, what are you doing about investigators in the reaction belt?
Yes, that could be an issue for people in the Southeast that have the reactions. Dr. Bendel's from Nashville, and that's kind of the epicenter of the reaction. So,
I mean, do you allow panitumumab, or they just can't go in the study?
If they aren't prepared to try cetuximab, they couldn't go on the study. That's just, we had to put on some parameters, so that was kind of the choice.
So going through some of the other research that you've been involved with, I wanted to ask you, I see you've been involved with a number of papers looking at TAS-102, and maybe you could comment a little bit on what we've learned about this agent. In particular, one of the things I was really curious about was this issue of the neutropenia that's seen with TAS-102, and the issue of, does that predict a better outcome and why? Can you talk about the work that you've done looking at that?
Yeah, well, TAS-102 is really an interesting drug. It's basically trifluorothymidine. So this was synthesized in the early 60s by Heidelberger, the same guy who gave us 5-FU and FUDR. It's another anti-metabolite. But the half-life is so short that you'd have to give it by prolonged infusion. So it was kind of abandoned until the Japanese came up with a metabolic inhibitor to increase the half-life. So it's a little bit like those combinations of oral 5-FU with DPD inhibitors, but this drug has an inhibitor of thymidine phosphorylase, which breaks down the TFT. So you can take it twice a day. The drug schedule is 5 days a week for 2 weeks. So you take it 5 days, get 2 days off, and then another 5 days, and that's supposed to be every 28 days. Now, it's not like the white count gets that low, that people are getting neutropenic fevers and really get into problem with neutropenia. The main thing that we're seeing is kind of a delay in neutrophil recovery. So when it comes to week four, when you're supposed to restart the next cycle, the ANC is less than 1,500. And in all the studies, you had to wait then. If it was 1,200 or 1,300, which we saw very frequently, you had to delay the patient another week. And so it turns out that for the patients that did have a little bit delayed recovery, their overall response rate was higher than the patients who didn't. And that suggests that there's some pharmacologic event going on here with those who have a higher AUC, have lower ANC nadirs and longer ANC recovery, and therefore those are the ones who benefit more. And there is some drug levels, pharmacology from the population pharmacokinetic studies that suggest that's true. So we did another analysis, not only in the pivotal trial, but in our own institutional experiences with Dr. Grothy from Mayo and also from another institution. And it looks like we had the same experience. People who have delayed recoveries tend to have a little bit better response rate.
From a clinical point of view, if you don't see that, do you think about increasing the dose?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose that one could postulate that. Personally, my interest in the drug is not so much continuing to use it in the heavily pretreated population, but kind of trying to move it earlier in combination, because it is another antimetabolite that can pair with drugs like irinotecan and oxaliplatin, and it's different than 5-FU as a fluoropyrimidine. It hits a different target, so actually goes directly into DNA as a phosphorylated base, and it's a lot more like gemcitabine in that way, in terms of the way it interacts with the DNA. So, you know, I think that these combinations may be used a little bit earlier when patients have had a lot of fluoropyrimidine already or a lot of 5-FU already. It's non-cross-resistant in preclinical studies.
I was going to ask you about that because that makes a lot of sense. What are some of the combinations or the trials out there that conceivably could lead to a change in clinical practice? And what are some of the kind of decision points that you could see potentially changing with these trials?
Well, we've done a study with the group at Memorial on irinotecan and bevacizumab with TAS, so Tasiri-Bev. And I was impressed that patients who had been heavily pretreated seemed to at least have stable disease or response. And so that's a regimen that may go forward. There's a publication in Lancet in the last couple months from the Japanese investigators who've had the drug longer. So they've already published a study now of TAS and bevacizumab, which looks active as kind of a combination similar to 5-FU-Bev. And in Europe, they're doing a study of TAS-Bev versus TAS, which is kind of like the AVIC study that had been done previously. So that's another study that's going on. We're doing a little institutional study at Yale of TAS and oxaliplatin, and that seems to have been tolerated very well. And the Europeans are actually doing a multi-center study of that combination as well. So I think that we'll be seeing some of these combinations being validated as options, and that'll be kind of figure out how to work those in as non-cross-resistant regimens, if it'll be in second line, you know, alternating first line, kind of what we were just discussing with the irinotecan. Now we have another fluoropyrimidine to work with.
So before we move on to some of the other papers you're involved with, since we talked about TAS-102, why don't we talk about one of your cases of a patient who actually received it, this 52-year-old man. So that's your second case. I don't know if you know who that is.
Yes.
Can you kind of briefly present what happened with this patient?
Sure. So he had rectal bleeding while he was on an NSAID in June 2011. And he had a clinical stage T3N1, and he was treated with neoadjuvant chemoradiation followed by surgery and then adjuvant FOLFOX, pretty much the way we would treat a standard rectal cancer for T3 or node positive. And he had a 5-centimeter moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma and no lymph nodes involved. So he was pathologic, YPT3N0. And then he did well for about another year, but he had a bone lesion then in his sacrum, which was treated with chemoradiation. And then he got 6 months of more adjuvant or quote adjuvant, secondary adjuvant therapy with FOLFIRI and bevacizumab. And that lasted about another year, and then he had additional recurrence. So we went back to FOLFOX Bev, which he got with a remission. Then he was on maintenance therapy with CAPE Bev for a while. In 2015, he got FOLFIRI again with aflibercept. And then he got irinotecan and panitumumab, which he did well on, but eventually progressed again. And so he was on the study of TAS and irinotecan for 8 months, and he did pretty well on that, but he eventually progressed. So he had the TAS-102 in combination, and then eventually he got regorafenib after that, but had a pelvic abscess, probably some kind of tumor perforation down in his pelvis.
So he sounds like it's a pretty complicated case, but maybe you could talk a little bit. I'm kind of curious how you approach the sequencing of TAS-102 and regorafenib in your own practice. What kind of patients, what might you start one on as opposed to the other? Do most people end up getting both?
Well, I think that many people can get both. Some people will progress on the first one and won't make it to the second one, so that's obviously the question. First of all, we have some data because the TAS approval was later, so we have some data from the pivotal trial for TAS-102 versus placebo that the patients who had gotten regorafenib, and that was about 17% of the patients, did just as well as the people who hadn't got regorafenib. So that's the one hard datum we have in this discussion. I think after that, it's kind of more what you believe about what the patient's tolerance is going to be, because in both those studies of the drug versus placebo, it appears that the benefit in terms of improvement in PFS and response rate is really fairly comparable. And there are some patients with regorafenib who have gotten prolonged remissions or stable disease with it. We see patients who have lung cavitation that shows that it's really working as well. So I think that there is a real benefit to both drugs. And for me personally, I think that the patient who's gotten a lot of fluoropyrimidines up to now, sometimes it's good to try a little bit different strategies, and I would tend to use regorafenib, especially if I'm not worried about their compliance and their ability to, you know, if they're going to have some hand-foot syndrome, that they can take care of themselves. If they seem like that will be a problem for them, then the TAS is pretty user-friendly, where the main thing is that if they don't get treated on week 4, they'll get treated on week 5.
So let's talk a little bit about immunotherapy of colon cancer, and particularly the issue of MSI high tumors. And to get into that, maybe you could talk a little bit. I was curious about this data set that was just presented at ASCO that you were part of in the CALGB and SWOG 80405, the Alliance study. But here you all were looking at somatic DNA mutations, MSI status, mutational load. You want to talk about what you looked at there, what you found, and what you think it means?
Well, the 80405 study was where we've had a lot of data on the right versus left side for the RAS wild type. So, I mean, I think we found in that patient population that the MSI high patients are pretty much what we've come to expect. They're, you know, few of them, but they respond to chemotherapy pretty much as well, if not a little better than other patients. But the other studies have tended to show that these are patients where immunotherapy may have a real large effect. So there have been studies for refractory patients with both pembrolizumab and nivolumab that have shown a very high response rate and a very prolonged disease-free survival. One of the other studies that I presented was with bevacizumab and atezolizumab, so the anti-PD-L1 together with bevacizumab, and we had 10 patients. It was kind of one arm of a basket study that involved a number of GI tumors, but for that patient population, it seems to have worked very well with 90% response or stable disease.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that study with the PD-1, atezolizumab, and bevacizumab. What's the thinking? You know, heard people talk about anti-angiogenics like Bev in some way having an immune-based effect, or that some of the benefits from an anti-immune effect or a permanent immune effect? What's the thinking behind all this?
There are no real randomized trials at the moment. I think that we could see one maybe in renal cancer or melanoma, but I mean, one theory is that because of the regulation of the kind of neovasculature that you see in tumors by blocking VEGF, you might be able to get the immune cells in better. They might be able to penetrate the tumors better because the tumor vessels are more normal. Another theory is that it may upregulate some of the expression of the PD-1 antigen or other immune antigens that allow for better immunotherapy. But again, I think that there's a lot of theory and some preclinical data, but very little clinical data to support that. It's just that in our study, it wasn't randomized or controlled, but we did seem to see a lot of benefit.
Can you summarize what we know right now about, first of all, the frequency of MSI-high, how much of that's somatic, how much of it's Lynch, and what we know about checkpoint inhibitors in these patients?
Right. So the MSI-high patients are about 4 or 5% of metastatic colon cancer. I mean, they start out more in stage 2 and stage 3, but a lot of those are cured in the earlier stages, especially the Lynch patients, because with the DNA repair defect, apparently the tumors are not as likely to develop metastases. But the ones who have metastatic disease, they have many DNA mutations, and they tend to be responsive to these anti-PD-1 drugs. The most common way that people get this condition is by inheriting gene defect for mismatch repair enzymes, you know, the four that we usually stain for, MSH and MLH. If one of those is inherited, a defective one is inherited from your parents, that's the basis of Lynch syndrome. And it's probably about 2/3 Lynch and 1/3 spontaneous in most of the studies that are coming out. Again, this is kind of a situation where we have some clinical data, but not a lot of large prospective trials, so we really have the numbers nailed down very carefully. But I would say it's about 2/3 Lynch and 1/3 sporadic. And if you develop a sporadic mutation in these mismatch repair enzymes, you're going to have the similar defect and a similar biology, and it seems to be equally responsive to anti-PD-1. Many of those aren't due to point mutations. Some of those are due to gene silencing, but it doesn't seem to matter for the PD-1 response.
Can you talk about what we know right now about specifically nivolumab and pembrolizumab and how the FDA indications are crafted and how that gets translated into non-protocol practice?
Right. Well, both drugs are now approved for previously treated MSI-high or mismatch repair deficient colorectal cancer. So I think that both can be used in practice. You know, my particular question is how to use this. Do we need to use it in combination? Do we need to use it sequentially? And so I think those are the questions at the moment. I mean, we know that people who've had a lot of chemo and are pretty sick can be literally resurrected with these drugs and can be treated for a long time, for really years on these therapies with minimal side effects. So it's amazing how well patients can do with this. But there's a first-line study going on from pembrolizumab versus chemo, so I think that's an important first-line study to determine. I have a patient on that study who responded really well to chemotherapy, as you might expect, because, you know, with platinum-based chemo and no ability to repair the DNA, they can do really well also. And he hasn't made it to crossover yet, and it's been a year and a half. So, you know, here's a patient that's done very well with chemo. So I don't know if the right thing to do is jump in with the anti-PD-1. We're going to be specifically answering that in a new NCTN study that's a collaboration between NRG and SWOG called the COMMIT study, which will be a first-line MSI-high study. And in that study, we'll be using atezolizumab, but it'll be chemo alone, atezolizumab alone, or the combination. And I think that'll give us some real answers to how to use the drug in first line also. So I encourage people to check the MSI status before you start chemotherapy for first-line metastatic disease and think about enrolling people to these trials.
That's an interesting point, though, that you made about patients doing better with platinum-based chemotherapy than non-MSI patients. Do we have any quantification of how much better?
I don't think this has been really studied systematically because, you know, they're pretty rare and they were kind of folded into all the other studies, so you got a few here and a few there. But these studies should really kind of give us a better handle on that.
So I wanted to go through another one of your cases. How about this 40-year-old man? Can you talk a little bit about this patient?
Yes, the one who was getting the atezolizumab-Bev combination.
Right.
So he is a 40-year-old, and he presented with rectal bleeding in December 2012. At that time, he was found to have a pathologic T4N2 rectal cancer, and he had 12 positive lymph nodes, so really high-risk patient. I wasn't seeing him at that time, but he was treated with adjuvant FOLFOX appropriately, and he completed the 6 months. And they tested him, and he was found to have Lynch syndrome, even though his family history was not that suggestive. So about a year later, he recurred in the abdomen with peritoneal disease, and he underwent debulking surgery with splenectomy, bowel resection, omentectomy, and resection of peritoneal metastases. And then he got a course of HIPEC at that same time. And he was again in remission for about another year, but he developed a new peritoneal metastases and a mesenteric nodal mass, which was then growing. It was found in April 2015 and growing in July 2015. And at that time, he was referred for our trial where he started on bevacizumab with atezolizumab. So that's more than 2 years ago. It's like 2 years and two and a third years already. So he had really a nice response. Peritoneal disease all went away. His mesenteric mass over the first year was stable, but then grew a little bit. So at that point, he was allowed to continue on study. So we gave him some radiation with SBRT to that nodal mass and continued the immunotherapy. And he's continued to do well. He hasn't had any further progression since that time. He has really no side effects. The bevacizumab was stopped about 6 months ago because of proteinuria. And, you know, we had been giving it to him intermittently for the 6 months before that. And so that's been discontinued, but he's still on atezolizumab and doing well.
Yeah, I noticed that about the proteinuria and the Bev. How much proteinuria did he have? And from your point of view, how much proteinuria do you need to have in order to stop Bev in a patient who's doing well?
Well, you know, I think the proteinuria to a large extent is a cumulative side effect if people stay on it for a long time and or related to not controlling the blood pressure too well. So those are the things that will predispose to proteinuria. Usually if it's getting up to a gram a day on a urine collection or a UPC, urine protein creatinine ratio greater than one, will hold it. And if you hold it for a few months, they can get some more Bev, but I think they tend to redevelop the proteinuria after that. It just causes kind of protein leak. And at some point, you know, it just continues on at a certain level. When I followed those patients after you stop the Bev, the proteinuria does resolve. It's just like it's very hard to keep starting and stopping it, and you can't treat them for that long before it comes back.
So you say this man's doing well on atezolizumab, no autoimmune problems whatsoever?
No, he hasn't had any autoimmune side effects. He hasn't had really any other side effects. He comes in for his infusion and keeps doing his normal stuff. You know, I would say he has a little bit of fatigue, he reports, but it's pretty benign compared to being on other treatments for a couple of years.
What have you observed in your own clinical practice in terms of autoimmune problems with checkpoint inhibitors? And, you know, there was some speculation when the anti-PD-L1 agents came out, like atezolizumab, that maybe it might have a different or more favorable toxicity ratio. How did that play out?
I think that it's a little hard to tell in GI cancers because we haven't used it that much. We don't have that many patients where it's approved. I mean, what we've seen, and I usually see this whenever I'm ward attending for my colleagues who treat lung cancer and melanoma, but clearly the patients who have combined immunotherapy with an anti-PD-1 or an anti-PD-L1 with an anti-CTLA-4, those patients tend to be at higher risk. But I must say that we've had some even single agent toxicity. We've seen some cardiomyopathy. We've seen interstitial lung disease occasionally. So, you know, all these things can happen once you set the immune system free. Sometimes it gets a little bit exuberant and begins to attack the normal tissue too.
It's interesting you mentioned cardiomyopathy because somebody just presented a case to me. I don't think it was colon cancer. I can't remember. You know, as you stated, everybody's trying these things of what I guess sounded like an autoimmune myocarditis. Is that what you had, a patient with that or patients?
We had one who had colon cancer, and then there have been a few more around our institution with lung cancer, melanoma, other diseases. But yeah, you can, I mean, what we've seen is they tend to get admitted with respiratory difficulty, and then the differential is it interstitial lung disease or cardiomyopathy, and then we'll end up seeing that their ejection fraction is kind of low, usually less than 30. With steroids, they usually recover.
Interesting.
So, but it can definitely cause some kind of autoimmune myocarditis as well.
Looking back at this man's history, this man with Lynch syndrome, first of all, I don't know if you were taking care of him when he had his first recurrence. That was in 2013. He had this big debulking surgery in HIPEC. Were you taking care of him then?
No, I wasn't.
What do you think about that strat? It really caught my attention. You got the HIPEC and debulking surgery. Nowadays, from your point of view, is that kind of a legitimate or something you would ever consider doing?
I'm personally not a big fan of HIPEC or any regional therapy. I mean, I've done a lot of intraperitoneal chemotherapy since I was a fellow and many trials with intraperitoneal chemotherapy and ovarian and gastric. HIPEC is just giving warm intraperitoneal therapy once at the time of surgery. I think there's a definite benefit from the debulking in terms of PFS and possibly survival, but there are no really good studies that have isolated the benefit of doing the HIPEC procedure. But, you know, it's becoming kind of a popular approach now that there are more of these surface malignancy centers and people are kind of looking for expertise in this area.
So also, I'm curious, looking back with the retrospectoscope at this case, when you look at what happened with this patient, so initially having 12 positive nodes, he gets adjuvant FOLFOX, looks like he had a pretty quick and extensive recurrence. If you were to see him or a patient like this again in that situation, would you have incorporated a checkpoint inhibitor, and which one, and would you have done any local therapy?
Well, again, there's no adjuvant data for use of anti-PD-1.
I'm talking about when he had his first recurrence.
Yeah. Well, I think at that point, that would fall within the indications that should be considered. But I do want to, again, call to people's attention that the NCTN cooperative groups will be starting an adjuvant therapy trial very shortly. The Alliance is going to be running that study, and I think that'll be very interesting to see if a checkpoint inhibitor is really effective in the adjuvant setting for colon cancer.
But this is MSI high?
All MSI high patients.
Wow, that's going to be interesting to try to accrue, huh?
Yes, that will be interesting. But I think right now, for new diagnoses, many, many institutions are routinely checking the MSI status. So I think we have a chance of getting that. The study is going to be chaired by Frank Sinicrope from Mayo. And, you know, we need a lot of patients for that study, but I think it's a worthwhile study.
Let's talk a little bit about BRAF disease, and I know you've had an interest in that in terms of clinical research, and maybe to get into it, you can begin by talking about your 48-year-old lady.
Yes. So this lady is actually a young woman who has three children in middle school and high school, and last summer she kind of developed bloating and various nonspecific symptoms. And eventually, in August, she underwent a colonoscopy and was found to have a sigmoid lesion that was obstructing and underwent a resection. At that time, the CAT scan on her initial staging showed extremely extensive disease with extensive involvement of the liver, like a packed liver, lung disease, peritoneal metastases. And she underwent a palliative resection because of her obstructive symptoms. And at that point, I saw her and we did her sequencing, and not too unexpectedly, she was found to have this BRAF V600E mutation, the kind of standard BRAF mutation. So I started her on FOLFIRINOX.
Can I just ask you about the way she was diagnosed here? She was diagnosed on a circulating DNA assay or what?
No. She was diagnosed on colonoscopy, and then she had the palliative resection, and then we sequenced her tumor. But when I started her treatment, I wanted to check her circulating tumor DNA more of a DNA marker, because we know that the panels can detect the circulating BRAF mutated DNA. And at that point, when she had this very extensive amount of disease, her circulating tumor DNA assay showed that she had 68% BRAF V600E present. So we treated her with the FOLFIRINOX, and she did really very well. Her liver lesions actually became more prominent because they were kind of necrotic and it changed the density. And our radiologist said, well, we do see this once in a while where even though they have a great anti-tumor response, she seems to have more lesions even. But her CEA had diminished from about 90 to 9 at the same time. So, and she was feeling much better. I mean, started to gain weight again. We knew she was responding. And when she got to the end of 12 cycles of the FOLFIRINOX, her circulating tumor DNA percent was down to 8% for the BRAF fraction.
Yeah, I don't know whether everybody knows this and I don't, but I've got to say, when I saw this, I was trying to remember from melanoma or even lung cancer, measurement of circulating DNA of BRAF. Is that commonly done?
Well, the panels now that are being done by the various companies are looking for specific mutations that are common. So they're all going to include that one amongst the other ones. So, you know, normally you'll get a report back that has whatever DNA is in the tumor that's being produced and circulating. So you'll see KRAS DNA. You know, if they have other mutations, it'll all come out in this panel where they give you the relative percentages.
So, for example, Guardant, is that this type of assay?
Yes, Guardant's one of them, and Foundation also has an assay like that.
And they report the percent of, what, tumor cells with this in it?
They isolate the tumor DNA that's circulating. It's in the bloodstream. It's not in any cells. It's just like from the cells giving off the DNA. It's not all digested, and some of it's circulating around, and you can look for these hotspot mutations that are point mutations that give the specific driver mutations that we're looking for. So when we know that people have like a KRAS codon 12 mutation or 13 or whatever it is on the BRAF V600E, they have probes to look for those specifically, or they do it on the panel and they report those specific DNA mutations. It's like, I think, about a 50 or 60 gene panel.
But what I'm trying to figure out is when they put percent, like it's percent of what?
The amount of circulating tumor DNA. Huh. It's not quantitated how much DNA you have there, but it's the relative frequency of that compared to the other DNA that's found there.
And does that percent in general correlate with response?
Well, that's a question. But there is some data for people who have stage 2 where they have a resection. If the DNA doesn't clear completely, they have a much higher risk of recurrence. And so we're looking, again, in the cooperative groups and other people are looking at also if we can use that as a predictive marker. In this case, I was trying to look at it as a response marker, and in her case, it seems to, because she kind of nadired out at 8%, but then it began to go up again when I gave her maintenance with just 5-FU-BEV, because she really couldn't continue to tolerate the FOLFIRINOX, obviously. And then we put her on a trial with a BRAF inhibitor. She was randomized to the arm of cetuximab with the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib, and she responded transiently for that, but after 4 months she was progressing again, and we saw that her DNA went up to 38%. So, I mean, she's had two responses to the therapy, but they haven't been very persistent.
And I see she's in nivolumab right now. How's she doing?
That's right. So far, she just started, and she seems to be tolerating it okay. I mean, she literally started it 2 weeks ago, so I don't know how she's going to respond.
How does her getting nivolumab tie into FDA indication, clinical research? Where did the nivolumab come from?
Well, we know that the patients that have BRAF mutations tend to have higher tumor mutation burden. It's not exactly in an FDA indication, and it was not approved by her insurance, but we managed to get her drug replacement off-label. So it would be considered an off-label use in the BRAF, but we know the BRAF patients have more mutations and a higher mutational burden than conventional colon cancer. So I think the studies in the future, we were going to try to focus on the use of these drugs in BRAF-mutated colon cancer also.
My understanding is that in general, colorectal cancer, metastatic colorectal cancer that's not MSI high doesn't respond hardly at all to checkpoint inhibitors. Is there any reason to think that BRAF does? I mean, other than theoretical, any data?
There are no clinical data yet.
Kind of reminds me of KRAS in lung cancer. I don't know why, but I guess because people think that maybe checkpoint inhibitors respond more. Really interesting. Where are we today right now with targeted therapy of BRAF mutant colorectal cancer?
So we reported at ASCO GI this year, and at the ASCO meeting, my colleague Scott Kopetz at MD Anderson presented the data from the SWOG trial, SWOG 1406. So in that trial, we randomized 100 patients to receiving a kind of standard regimen of irinotecan cetuximab versus the same two drugs with the specific BRAF inhibitor, vemurafenib. And people know that drug because it is an approved drug for melanoma, but it is considered off-label for colon cancer. In our study, the group that got the vemurafenib, the primary endpoint was PFS. So the PFS was really twice as long. The hazard ratio for the comparison was 0.48. So they went twice as long to progress. And the response rate was around 25%. As opposed to 4% in the control arm. So we think that that's going to be very beneficial for patients. That's, again, second or third line patients who hadn't received cetuximab. That was the basic eligibility for that study. And I believe that that will make it into guidelines soon so that we hope that patients will be able to access the vemurafenib for the treatment of BRAF-mutated colon cancer after they've received some first-line chemotherapy. But I do want to add that you need to give an anti-EGF drug with it. If you just give the BRAF inhibitor alone, it's not very active. It's not like melanoma. So you've got to give it with either cetuximab, as we did in our study, or with panitumumab, as has been done in some other studies.
So I take it from what you're saying that you would like to be able to use this combination of vemurafenib, irinotecan, and cetuximab outside a trial setting right now for your patients.
Yes. Yes.
And what about MEK inhibitors, of course, in not just melanoma, but even lung cancer? We're seeing those combinations be used. Vemurafenib has been paired with cobimetinib in melanoma, and then you have dabrafenib and trametinib. What about that strategy or that combined with an anti-EGFR antibody?
Right. So in this study that is currently ongoing, the so-called Beacon study, that is including a MEK inhibitor in one of the arms also. One of the arms is cetuximab and the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib, and the other arm is cetuximab, encorafenib, and binimetinib, which is the MEK inhibitor. And then the third arm is a control with just chemo and cetuximab. So that, I think, will be a direct comparison of how much benefit a MEK inhibitor would provide for BRAF. And hopefully it'll be like melanoma and they'll do better. The data from there was a 30-patient safety lead-in to that randomized phase 3 study that was just presented at ESMO. And in that combination of cetuximab, encorafenib, and binimetinib, so an anti-EGFR drug, a BRAF drug, and a MEK drug, the response rate was over 40%, and the PFS wasn't reached. The median time for patients to be on study was almost 6 months, over 5.5 months, but 3/4 of the patients were still on treatment. So that actually may be a much more effective regimen than just the triplet we had with chemo, but we'll need to see how that turns out.
I'm kind of trying to get a global feel for BRAF mutant disease and colon cancer and targeted therapy. I've had the impression that it's just completely a different ballgame than melanoma and even lung cancer. I mean, lung cancer right now, BRAF positive disease investigators are treating with targeted therapy and first line metastatic disease. But colon never seemed to kind of have that, I don't know, sort of sensitivity. You're bringing in the antibody, et cetera. Globally, do you really think that targeted therapy is going to be helpful once you kind of get it right?
Yes, I do. I think that it will be helpful. I mean, the median survival for BRAF mutated metastatic disease is around a half, 50% of non-mutated. So that's a very poor prognosis group. I think the reason that we haven't made as much progress yet is twofold. First, that the BRAF inhibitor by itself did not work. So we needed to discover that you needed to pair it with an anti-EGFR. And the second thing is, it's still pretty rare, you know, 4 or 5% of all colon cancer, so the studies take a lot longer to do. And those are the things that have slowed down the development. But I think aggressive chemotherapy with these combinations and possibly adding some immunotherapy eventually should really help these patients do substantially better than where we started at.
Just to close out here, any other research strategies or agents in colon cancer that you're excited about that we haven't talked about today?
Well, I think the other discovery or observation that's going to be very interesting and that we'll see clinical data on very soon is the use of the MEK inhibitor with immunotherapy for garden variety or microsatellite stable colon cancer. So, as we heard from Johanna Bendel's study, if you added cobimetinib to atezolizumab, 25-30% of patients seemed to respond to immunotherapy, and without the cobimetinib, it was, you know, 1 or 2%. So it seems as though the MEK inhibitor can really have a major effect on upregulating the immunogenicity of colon cancer and activating the T cells so that they are more responsive to the atezolizumab. So the three-arm study that was done internationally has been accrued. It accrued very rapidly, and we're waiting to see how that pans out. In our institution, I think we managed to get 8 patients on before the study closed, which was really, it opened and closed pretty quickly. But we do have a couple patients still on, and they were people who were on the combination arm. So I think that this might be a real lead.
What is the actual randomization?
It was, the control arm was regorafenib. One arm got the cobimetinib and atezolizumab, and then there was a atezolizumab alone arm. Hmm. So it's 3 arms.
And how many people they accrue?
Over 500. It was a large phase 3 trial.
Hmm. Interesting. I wonder, I mean, it's interesting that they did a randomized study. I was thinking to myself, if they did a big phase 2 and they showed a 25% response rate and the responses lasted, you know, a couple years, would that be enough? Or do you need to really do this kind of randomization?
Right. Well, it's always, you know, better to have more definitive controlled data, but it's hard to predict with the regulatory environment today, you know, what you really need to have. A phase 3 study that shows a real benefit over a standard approved regimen in 3rd or 4th line will be very helpful. And I think especially with the cost of these drugs, it's going to be important to show how beneficial it is. So we will see.
When do you think we will see?
I think some of the data should be coming out by next year sometime, probably next year for ESMO. I don't think it'll make it for the ASCO meeting, but I imagine by the end of the year we'll have some data.